Thank you. I'm Dallas Bertraw at Resources for the Future. I'm pleased to be here today. I'm substituting for Alan Krupnik, who intended to give this presentation, but I think I can take you through the main points of our review of the economics of the issue and work that's ongoing at Resources for the Future. Okay, I'm going to talk about three things: the role of natural gas, that natural gas plays on our economic system, the benefits from the revolution of natural gas in the economy, and the costs or damages from that expansion and supply of natural gas and economic activity. First, I want to start with a spaghetti diagram from the Energy Information Administration. On the left of this diagram, this major sources of energy in the economy, and in the middle there is natural gas, the bright blue. What's notable about natural gas in this picture is that, unlike any of the other fuel sources, it is feeding into a vast majority of the economy in four of the five sectors that are identified. At the top, electricity generation, which it shows here much smaller than coal in 2009. I'm going to show you that that has expanded greatly to come very close to equaling coal as an input to electricity generation. It also feeds directly into residential, commercial, and industrial energy use for heating and cooling and industrial processes. And the little thin line dropping down to the bottom, there's many advocates who call for expanded role of natural gas through compressed natural gas as fuel for transportation, and potentially a relatively clean fuel for transportation, depending. This shows the large global shale gas resource potential. The white areas are those that have been assessed, and the red is where there exists a resource estimate of the available natural gas in a play in that region. Gray is the area that has not been assessed. I draw your attention to a couple aspects of this map. First is Poland. You see dark red in northeastern Europe. This is very important from a geopolitical perspective because it represents a potential competition with Russia for natural gas supply to Europe. So it's of keen interest in the European continent. However, we're learning that the same technologies that have worked in North America do not appear to be taking hold in the same way in Poland. Costs are greater there because of the geology. In China, there's some important natural gas resource, but in northern China, this is one of the major issues that emerged as water scarcity, and the competition in use for water to various purposes makes it perhaps difficult to extract natural gas in northern China. That is less true in southern China. Australia is starting to expand rapidly as an international source of global source of natural gas. And then finally, it's of interest that Africa is largely unassessed, but where there has been an assessment, there's important resource potential in the continent of Africa. In North America, there is just a myriad potential sources of identified natural gas supply. In the dark pink are the current shale plays, that is areas that have come into production. The Barnett Shale in Texas and Marcellus Shale, a shallower shale in Pennsylvania and New York State. And then the Bakken Shale up in North Dakota is of interest because it's come under a lot of environmental criticism, because the natural gas there is actually largely getting flared because it's ancillary to oil production, petroleum extraction in North Dakota. So it's a byproduct almost and the lesser valued fuel. Storage is full because there has been such an expansion in natural gas, and with that expansion in natural gas has been a decline in the price of natural gas, so it's not currently economic to build additional storage or additional pipelines from that region to the national grid. So natural gas is actually being flared in that region, which of course has greenhouse gas implications, and it's a waste. This shows that in the absence of shale gas, which is the top portion here, there would be a declining supply of natural gas in North America, and that would have energy security issues from the standpoint that the U.S. would become increasingly dependent on international supply. Remember, it was only 4, 5, or 6 years ago where a rather controversial topic was liquefied natural gas, and the import of that, the danger risks associated with large terminals bringing in natural gas to the U.S. Now that may be reversed. The U.S. may become a natural gas exporter, and maybe some of the same accident risks are associated with that, but the situation has greatly changed with natural gas production because of the shale gas discoveries. And here I want to show you that a historic moment when gas actually caught up with coal in terms of its contribution to electricity generation. Notwithstanding the potentially important and controversial and unknown at this point fugitive emissions of methane from gas extraction, which I'm sure will be talked about over the course of this panel, which has, you know, greenhouse gas implications of that. Notwithstanding that, natural gas has about half the emissions rate in generating electricity as does coal. So the and also I'm going to mention lower emissions of a number of other conventional air pollutants. So just in the combustion phase in the electricity cycle, this is really good news for public health and the environment. That it looks like going forward that this gas is going to be competing with coal. Here are alternative cases for resource potential from the Energy Information Administration. The black line is the reference case. And then there's a high and low estimated ultimate recovery. And then the highest case is also technologically optimistic scenario. I would not infer from this that there's somehow an asymmetric distribution that things are, could be way, way better or more expansive than already the case. It shouldn't indicate any sort of probability distribution leaning to the high side. That's pretty much, experts seem to think it's symmetric around the reference case, but this resource potential is expected to be growing over time. And this is what the prices are going to be. You see that over the last decade or so, natural gas prices increased, were volatile, but increased by over a factor of four. That led to a number of economists calling this to be a potential crisis for industrial and chemical activities in North America. And then with the shale gas explosion and identified shale gas resource supply, the price fell precipitously and also has become much more stable than it had been over the course of the otherwise volatile history of natural gas prices up and down, up and down. The black line indicates the reference case going forward, and then a number of scenarios, alternative technological scenarios about what might happen to prices in the future. I'm going to draw your attention to this one purple line, which is a $25 fee on carbon dioxide emissions in the economy, and this is what would be expected to happen to prices in that scenario, where they would rise above the reference case as natural gas would come in as sort of the bridge fuel to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the economy, substituting for coal and electricity generation especially, that would drive up the price of natural gas, but eventually it would fall back down to the reference case as it is thought that other lower non-emitting technologies would come in to compete, like nuclear power and renewables. So under this kind of a greenhouse gas scenario. These are scenarios that are done by the EIA, Energy Information Administration. And let's see, this is just about finally on the economy. I want to show you that this is EIA's reference case mix. Electricity demand is expected to continue to grow over the next decades, but the contribution of coal to that has tailed off, is essentially leveled out, and the difference, the growth that is going to occur is going to be met, EIA thinks, by expanded the role for natural gas plus an expanded role for renewables and nuclear. I emphasize this includes no representation of any greenhouse gas policies because that's EIA's modeling practice. Then any policy that is not finalized is not represented in their scenario. So, for example, greenhouse gas rules under the Clean Air Act, which is very much something that's real and moving forward, and is the default outcome unless Congress steps in to change that, is not represented in this picture. That should lead to reduced use of coal, if anything. Okay, so the benefits of cheap gas. We would identify cheaper electricity, cheaper home and commercial heating, a possibility of reduced oil consumption and transportation with an energy security benefit. Again, we have an international fuel market, so it's not like it's going to it's not like energy security. The meaning of energy security here is that there's the it's a safeguard against supply disruption. But the issue here is that oil consumption in transportation really doesn't substitute directly with natural gas. It's only if, so right now this is a very, very minor issue. It's only if natural gas moved into transportation through expanded use of compressed natural gas, or if natural gas expands substantially in contributing to electricity and we see a broad electrification of the vehicle fleet, that this energy security benefit would be realized. There's an economic revitalization in some issues. The political import of that should not be lost. It's one of the big issues on the table. And avoidance of energy security issue associated with having to import natural gas directly. There's a lower conventional pollutants from the electricity sector, especially from coal. The SO2 cap being non-binding, that is that, you know, from 1990 there was a cap and trade system in place for sulfur dioxide. That cap has been tightened through regulatory measures, but now we're moving into a period where other regulatory measures have tightened down on SO2, that cap is not binding anymore. Emissions are actually lower than the cap. So anything that was to lead to a substitution from coal towards natural gas or renewables, if you will, leads to real further reductions in sulfur dioxide emissions from the electricity sector. And then there's lower ancillary damages from coal associated with mountaintop removal, acid mine damage, mining accidents, fly ash buildup, et cetera. Okay, so now something about the costs and damages of shale gas. There's indirect pathways from the substitutions to other fuels in that it could be crowding out the investment in renewables or nuclear, which has benefits or costs depending on one's perspective. But this is something that's really of concern if you're motivated by the issue of greenhouse gases and climate change. There's a lot of concern that the natural gas might be our ally in the short run and the problem in the long run as the economy wants to move away from fossil fuels in the long run. And then there's the direct measures, which are the risks for mining, producing, transporting, and burning shale gas and conventional gas. So this last issue, the direct measures, were the focus of an 18-month study that's still ongoing and wrapping up at Resources for the Future, funded by the Sloan Foundation, and it was intended to look at four things. Understanding 264 impact pathways, and I'll explain what I mean by that in just a minute. Estimate the public willingness to pay to avoid potential damages, review state regulations, and they vary quite a bit across the country, and conduct a statistical analysis linking shale with surface water quality in Pennsylvania. So this is a picture of what I mean by creating the impact pathways. For example, one activity that creates burdens is on-road vehicle activity. It leads to greater emissions of conventional air pollutants, noise pollution, road congestion. This has intermediate impacts, which are air quality and community disruption, and then final impacts, which range everything from morbidity, health changes, climate change impacts, aesthetics, and time loss through congestion on roads and associated costs with that. We have 264 of these pathways identified. These pathways in the study end at the intermediate impacts because we lacked the resources to involve the expertise on the final impacts and actually quantifying, and the literature doesn't support, in some cases, it does for air quality, but in many of the other cases, quantifying what the final impacts would be. So we're looking at intermediate impacts and the 264 pathways identified. And then expert elicitation process, we showed these pathways in a matrix format to experts from four groups, which I'll identify in a minute for you, and they were shown matrices such as these. On-road vehicle activity, for example, the one that highlighted here in the top panel, with blue going across, it has an effect on stormwater flows, conventional air pollutants and CO2, noise pollution, road congestion, etc. And experts were asked to identify, without the ability to give any strength of preference, they were asked to identify which of these are meaningful, important, or worthy of further research and understanding. So the identified priorities for further regulatory voluntary action are out of the 264 pathways, there were four groups that were involved in this: NGOs, industry, academia, and government, with a bit heavier weighting in representation from academics and industry, but an attempt to balance throughout. And what I want to show you, what I want to draw your attention to here is of the 20 out of those 264, the 20 pathways which received the most votes, if you will, are represented here. What's remarkable is that 12 of them were overlapped and appear to rise to the surface as those from all four constituency research groups as those that are the most important. So these included seven surface water pathways, two groundwater pathways, two air quality, and one habitat. Just a couple other observations about this expert elicitation. Industry priority is for community impacts. Actually, that's where greatest weight by industry was. So rather than what we might think of as the health impacts or environmental health impacts, the industry's concern is the impacts that the expansion in economic activity at the rural level is having on communities, possibly because they face the greatest blowback from those kind of impacts. In general, though, the other thing to note is that the top damages identified by all four groups are not from fracking per se, but rather from many of the activities associated with conventional gas extraction. It's just that now they're happening writ large in much greater magnitude and in the diverse rural communities throughout the country. So it's the impacts have just expanded or almost an explosion in activity in natural gas extraction rather than fracking per se, that at least as identified by these experts in these four groups. The other thing that experts were asked was the possibility of unforeseen accidents where they could look at 14 types of accidents and explain and put an assessment on the probability of them happening and whether damages were going to be assessed from very low to medium to very high. And without taking the time to explain anything more about those, I just want to show that there's a difference of opinion here. So if we look at this picture and say what NGOs see with respect to some potential for medium or very high damage outcomes with moderately important probabilities assigned, industry feels much differently about that. They feel the chance of unforeseen accidents are much less. That's perhaps not surprising, but it does drive the public debate. Then there's a variety of public health studies, and other speakers on this panel are going to get much further into this, that look at the activities, burns, intermediate pathways, exposures, and health effects. And some of the activities all the way through to health effects that appeared in the literature include McKinsey et al. Looking at cancer risks from Wells in Colorado and Hill neonatal effects. There are studies that look at from burden type to health effects without looking at specifically the activities that lead to those burdens, but still following the pathways that associate with natural gas extraction by Coburn. And then with respect to intermediate impacts on health effects, there's really a huge number of studies, and they don't necessarily have to grow out of the natural gas supply phenomenon because they draw on many of the previous literature in public health. I do want to just show you this picture that shows what is some of the unexploited data that exists and that we're using now in a statistical analysis. This is reported data for a number of chemical constituents that's required to be reported from mines in Pennsylvania to the Department of Environmental Protection on their Form 26R. So you can collect this kind of information and then do analysis, geographic analysis, looking at the effects of people resident to those sites. Not very much of this work has been done yet, and it's important, and there's plenty of opportunities to do more of this. Implications for public health, to sort of summarize. There's lots of local conditions that have been identified as really important to the affected communities, from stemming from geology, hydrology, the proximity of people to these sites, drinking water sources, operator choices that may pose all sorts of impacts on local communities. The regulatory environment all matter to make generalizing difficult. There's surface water pathways. We think that they are minimal, or that we think, drawing on the opinions of experts, that they are minimal unless major water supply is reached. That might be like saying, other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how did you enjoy the play? But as of now, there's not strong evidence that major water supply, there might be concern, but not strong evidence that major water supply has been reached or would be reached. There's groundwater pathways. Small number of people are likely exposed here. No clear evidence. Small possibility of major aquifer contamination. There's air pollution pathways along the lines of conventional pollutants, and then the methane and global warming effect. The jury is still out on this. The range of estimates are that from 1 to 7%, that's a pretty big range, of methane is lost. And since methane has a much greater greenhouse gas warming potential than CO2, if it was towards the high end of that, if 7% of the methane that's being extracted is actually lost to the environment as methane, not even as being flared and then turned into CO2, but being lost as methane, that would have very deleterious greenhouse gas impacts. If it's 3% or less, then on net, the substitution of natural gas for coal would be a greenhouse gas benefit. The habitat, we don't see evidence that there's any real effect for natural resource habitat. Community disruption is important. There's stress and trauma, stress both from real things like noise and stress from perceived things like health effects, whether they're real or not. If they're perceived, they're real. There's trauma from traffic accidents, water shortages exacerbated by drought, and naturally occurring radioactive materials. Actually, in Texas, where the use of wastewater was, I think it was Texas, sorry if I'm confused there, was used for in de-icing and then caught spreading norms around a lot of places without control. So that's now come to an end. And the bottom line is that substituting gas for coal is probably a good thing, because even if methane emissions mean its global warming potential exceeds coal, this is Alan Krupnik's finding and one which I would concur, it's a lot easier to reduce, to put regulation in place and to put technology in place to reduce the fugitive methane emissions than to develop economic carbon capture and storage technology for coal or pass a cap and trade or carbon tax on coal, or so it appears from recent experience in Congress. So it would require public policy focus and regulatory intent to regulate the natural gas extraction industry to capture those fugitive methane emissions. But that would seem much easier to do than breakthrough technological applications through CCS at coal plants. There's direct public health effects from pollutants that are, but they're unlikely to be large, it appears. Direct effects on communities, which could be large, and indirect effects could be large, but it's unclear which direction they go, whether they're net benefit or net cost. So for more information about this, this is the title of the study, which you can Google and find information about it, Managing the Risks of Shale Gas at Resources for the Future.
Thank you.
I'll take a couple questions if there are any. Sir?
The question was the my assertion, the ability to.
Right. Will there be the ability or the expectation to regulate?
The question is, if Romney became president, would be the same opportunity or ability to regulate fugitive methane emissions as if Obama was president? Implicitly, I agree. If Romney was president, it would seem there would be much less attention focused on greenhouse gas associated with fugitive methane emissions, or a much less push to have to develop carbon capture and storage technology for coal, or to regulate through the Clean Air Act greenhouse gas regulations on coal. So the effect on greenhouse gases through any fuel type is going to be much affected if Romney were president instead of Obama, I would think.
Sir?
Yeah, I would just have to, at this point, I would be conjecturing. I'm hoping that some of the other speakers
have
the background.
We're not going to cover seismic activity.
So the question was, what about seismic activity? That is the suspicion and some evidence that fracking has led to at least small-scale and localized earthquakes, and what could be the long-run implications of that. And Walter says there's nobody that's going to direct that.
Yeah, we don't
address
have
that, and I really don't have the expertise to talk about it further. Sorry. That's a good question.
Just one more.
Any evaluation of impact on drinking water, especially underground sources of drinking water, how significant was your evaluation of migration, either vertically or laterally, especially in light of the abandoned wells, which might violate the integrity of the confining zone?
So the question is, how extensive was our evaluation of the ability of chemicals to migrate, either laterally or vertically, when looking at the effects on drinking water? So I guess that's a really useful question because it clarifies the limitations of the study. We don't have a technologically based study here. This was expert elicitation, and so the question is what kind of emphasis do experts put on that question, and what do they understand about that right now? That's the most I can say about it as it's reflected. So there's some more narrative about that in the study itself, but there's no original contribution there in terms of a technological assessment about that.
Thank you.
Okay.